Hillary Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember. Even with a busy speaking and radio schedule, she finds time to devote to her creative love of dance. Don Johnson is an author, speaker, and major motion picture film producer. Both hold master's degrees in theology, and together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. From the Southern California studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending with Don and Timmery.
You get all kinds of happiness advice on the internet from people who don't know what they're talking about. Don't trust them. That's the advice from an author at the week this week. Welcome, Don and Timmery with you. Happiness is a pretty big deal. Happiness is what we're all searching for, isn't it? I mean, isn't that the bottom line? We all just want to be happy?
We all just want to be happy, and we do and choose things because we think that's what will make us happy. Whether or not it does, that's the reason we choose it.
Yeah, I think at the baseline, right, the bottom level, if I go and do something, it's because I think I will gain some sort of happiness from it. That's sort of a Aristotelian sort of deal. Like,
exactly.
Yeah, we're all after the good, right? And even when we do bad things, we hope that there will be some happiness, joy, good, something that will benefit us. Yet, I'm not sure that a lot of people are all that successful at being always happy.
Genuinely happy. Well, if you think about it, we have so many coping mechanisms, such as eating to make ourselves happy, right? We're down, we like to eat. And part of that is that dopamine's being released into the brain. It makes us feel good. There's a sense of pleasure. When we are down, we recognize, even if we don't necessarily have the motivation, sometimes when we exercise, when we're depressed, that can help us to feel better. We have different things like the endorphins that are kicking in and being released. These happy chemicals that are released in the brain that are so fundamental, where you see this level of science playing into how we find and seek happiness.
Okay, so when we talk about happiness, especially at that sort of chemical level, let's just stop there for a second, because this is what this article actually is talking about. It says, don't trust those people who are going to promise you happiness, but trust neuroscience, because the neuroscientists have the answer. In fact, UCLA neuroscience researcher Alex Korb has some insights for us that he claims create an upward spiral of happiness in your life. Now, this was interesting to me. Whenever I see sort of, hey, you can be happy, I'm always like, on one hand, cynical about it. But then on the other hand, I'm like, well, yes, what have they discovered? What can we do? Like, you're genuinely interested, right? And this is one of those stories, Timmery, where I find that the old adage about scientists who climb and climb and climb and work and research and do all that stuff and get to the top of the mountain, when they get there, they find that the theologians have been there all along.
I think that that is a fantastic example here, because I myself can be a little bit of a sucker for like 4 things to improve your morning.
Yeah, yeah.
5 things, like a Verily magazine always has like those 5 things to improve your relationship. Those 2 things you need for your wardrobe to make it look better this spring. Like very turnkey things. I think in general we like them. And so when I saw these 4 rituals that will make you happy from neuroscience, that neuroscience revealed, I thought that's fascinating, because what we learn on the level of the brain, on the level of the chemicals of the body, the chemistry of the body is consistent with human nature. No wonder we're wired in a certain way. And not only that, but human nature and faith go together. Grace builds on nature. And this is where I see the different tips they have and how consistent they are with things like prayer life, with generosity, with the importance of community. And I think that we should just dive right into them because they say so much.
Yeah, so they offer 4 things from neuroscience that will help make you happy. 4 tips. I'm a sucker for these lists too. Here's number 1 is you should be grateful.
So you should ask yourself what you're grateful for, essentially.
Yeah, essentially ask yourself what you are grateful for. Mm-hmm. Now, this is interesting to me because, of course, from a Christian perspective, this is key, right? This is like fundamental to existence.
But do we really do it?
Well, I'm like, not
honestly,
saying we do it, but I'm saying, like, according to Christian theology, right? Like, what are we? Well, we are creatures. And as creatures, we are dependent on someone else. That's baseline. The sin of the fall is pride, thinking that we made ourselves or we can do our own thing, right? Like we can get out there and be the masters of our destiny. What's the antidote to that? Well, it starts with, I think, being humble, but humility really starts with a measure of gratitude,
yes,
just for being alive, right?
Well, and that's like when you begin prayer, we're called to place ourselves in the presence of God.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite ways to do that, two of them, one is recognize everything at this very moment, every person, everything is constantly being created into existence. If God wasn't creating us, making us in that moment, we would cease to exist. This is a philosophical understanding. And in that moment, I can be grateful that everything I am and have is from God. And I recognize there's really nothing that I can do to make me, in a sense, worthy or to like kind of have this quid pro quo, like you did that, I can do this. Like God is infinitely good and perfect. I can't meet that. Not only that, he created us. Now he died on that cross for us, right? And so there's this attitude that you're saying that we should just be perpetually grateful and trying to match up to it. But I think that we don't really have that perspective a lot of the time in our day in and day outs when we're struggling through the day.
Oh, absolutely we don't. And that's where things like stress and anxiety, a lot of the times stress and anxiety is thinking, hey, I need to be in control of this situation. I've got all of these other factors that I don't feel in control of. Therefore, I'm stressed. They're saying, as neuroscientists, think of something to be grateful for. Think of something that it's not dependent on you.
Yes.
It's there not because of you.
Well, and it's neat because they even talk about how it's not just the fact that, okay, about finding that thing you're grateful for, but it's the process of gratitude. It's that searching to be grateful. It's changing your mindset. And what happens on the level of the brain is that the neurotransmitters then begin to receive a boost of serotonin. Serotonin is a chemical that's released in many different situations. It's kind of the chemical in a sense of serenity.
Yeah.
Of peacefulness. It's something that's released when people have sex. It's something great. But it also can be stifled when we're not thinking right. And so what happens on the level of the brain, especially in part of the frontal anterior or the anterior cortex of the brain, is that serotonin begins to be leaked into the brain and it activates and helps to overcome this attitude of guilt and shame that we might have, or where we're dwelling on something, we suddenly have, ah, I'm grateful that for this. It might even be the roof over your head or whatever it might be. It's simple. Well, I can be grateful that I have these few minutes to stop and think about what I'm grateful for. I can be grateful for my faith, for my family. Whatever it is, we can find those little things or large things.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Trending with Dawn and Timory. We are looking at an article that claims to offer us four tips for being happy from neuroscience. The first one was that we should think of something to be grateful for. Now, whenever it comes to neuroscience and these sort of, you know, quote, scientific articles, I'm always a little bit hesitant to sort of accept them completely, because often they come from a very materialistic worldview. And this is one of the reasons I actually brought this article up, because they're claiming to offer these four tips. Well, when you think positively, when you think gratefully, these things are released in your brain. And you just pointed it out. That's actually a fact. I mean, they're not making this stuff up. This stuff does happen.
God wired us this way.
But there's a difference between saying that, you know, God made us this way and this helps us as complete human beings, like it's part of the whole package. Or it is the whole package. And this is my fear with some of these things. And it makes me sort of question a little bit their approach. Because they're saying, well, be grateful because it releases these chemicals and you'll feel better. So is that morally equivalent to like taking a drug that would do the same thing, or watching porn that might do the same thing? I mean, are these things morally equivalent? Because you're just focusing on that physical factor. Now, as a Christian, I'm saying, yeah, that physical factor is real. But you know why it's real? Because we were made to be grateful, because we are creatures, and that's part of the process, right? But
well,
it's not.
Well, and are your means good means to achieve that happiness, too?
Right.
Like porn in and of itself, we can say without a doubt, even if you want to justify looking at it, porn in and of itself is not a good thing, because it does not do a good thing toward another person.
But we wouldn't say that it's only utilitarian, though. You're absolutely right, Timory, right? But we would say that porn objectifies, it doesn't love, we were made for love. I guess the point I'm making sort of on a bigger scale is I think these neuroscientists have stumbled upon, well, maybe not stumbled, they've researched hard and looked at the facts, and good on them for doing that. But what they have reached is part of the truth.
They're right? Like, neuroscience is life, as my little sister would say. It is life. It's not, and that's what you're trying to say.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, yes, you've stumbled upon this truth, but it doesn't end there. You can't just try to be grateful for the chemicals that are released. No, the reason being grateful is a good thing is that we are actually creatures dependent on God, and that puts us in touch with reality. Mm-hmm. It's not just a utilitarian thing to help us feel better. And I think the rest of these tips, they go along that same path. Like, they point out the chemical reactions that are happening. Mm-hmm. Good. But it's interesting that, for instance, we're going to talk here later about what you should do with guilt and why you should have friends and why you should touch other people. And, well, does it have something to do with the fact that, again, we were made by God for love to have other people? I hesitate to think that some people might go to others and say, well, we need to have physical contact because I need that
physical contact.
I need that chemical reaction in my brain to feel better.
Yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying. The faith and the science are consistent. This moral truth is consistent with the science. God made us that way. And we can't discredit science. We can't discredit faith.
Absolutely. All right, we'll have the other three tips that neuroscientists offer us to be happy, and we'll compare whether or not they've maybe touched on a truth that Christians have known for many millennia already.
Timmery and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E and at Don Johnson Media. From the studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending. Trending with Don and Timmery, applying timeless principles to today's hottest topics.
So, happiness, it's fundamental to who we are. We're looking for it in everything we do. We usually choose things based on happiness. We're going through four of the rituals that are recommended from a UCLA neuroscientist, Alex Korb, talking about what can we do to make us happy. And the first one, just to wrap it up, is by asking, what am I grateful for? And you know what stood out to me here, Dawn, is that in a lot of the new spiritual ideas, and especially in yoga, a lot of what they have the attitude of, and we're not getting into the debate over yoga right now. It's a really important
one.
Maybe another time. But yoga, part of the attitude in it is they open it with this attitude of gratitude and being, what are you grateful for sometimes? And also setting an intention, offering your workout for other people. And I have a close friend who's very into yoga, and I find it so interesting because what she thinks is just this neat practice of self-betterment is actually an act of faith and worship. And it's fundamental to Christianity, and how this simple attitude of neuroscience and the fact that in asking what we're grateful for, we receive serotonin, right? We start to have the chemicals in our brain kicking off. I think it's pretty cool where I think this opens a conversation to people who are doing yoga or whatever they're doing, where how can we find this attitude of gratefulness and what people see as a good and how it ties back to our faith.
Yeah, isn't that what most of these tips boil down to, isn't it? They have found some aspect of reality, you know, meditation, right? Being silent or being a part of a small group. You've found something that's real and true and good and beautiful. And as Catholics, we come on board and we say, yes, that is true and good and beautiful. And the reason it is because we were created a particular way. And and a lot of times in modern life, we're missing out on some aspect of reality. And so you see things like yoga or these tips that the neuroscientists have offered us. And you say, yeah, that's exactly right. You should be grateful, not just because of the chemical thing, but because of who we are. Let's go through the last three a little more quickly here. So the second one is we are to label our emotions And then we are to make a decision basically about something.
So twos label your emotions, whether you're sad, you're anxious, you're angry, whatever it is. Because when we're stuck in it, we don't understand what it is. It makes us difficult to move past it versus say, I'm just like really upset and dwelling on something. Maybe if I just recognize I'm actually just feeling sad.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay, I'm feeling sad about X, Y, and Z. There's a little bit of peace that's released, and you allow some of the arousal and the limbic system and the prefrontal cortex. Again, I'm talking about these parts of the brain because right. literally when we start to go, okay, I'm just sad, you're allowed then to name it and move on. So label your negative feelings as this attitude. I think it's good because sometimes we get stuck and we just dwell on it and it interrupts us when we're praying, for example. And you can't take something into prayer if you're just babbling on and on. Well, this happened to me. But if you say, God, I'm actually really sad about this, you then have more of an intention, a prayer, something that you can go, okay, that's okay that I'm sad that this person in my life just died.
You think part of it might be that in the act of praying, for example, or labeling our emotions, the act in and of itself sets you outside of yourself a little bit.
Yes.
Right? Like you're not just solely focused on yourself right now. You are trying to look objectively from the outside at yourself and label, well, what emotion am I having right now? And what can I offer to God? And this sort of thing. It's the act in and of itself that is actually taking you out of the big problem. And the big problem, ultimately, in many of these cases, is that you are completely enclosed on yourself.
Yes.
Like, that's a sin. You know, it encloses you on yourself. You're unable to see reality for what it is.
And this is what's so interesting about that one, too, kind of tying it into, like, big picture and, like, situational. The FBI actually uses this labeling of feelings in FBI hostage negotiations because we can be so set in on ourselves and the situation. But if you begin to kind of identify that feeling and say, well, this is what it is, it helps in further communicating and moving forward, which can help in basic arguments and conversations even.
Right. And then the next one is to make a decision. Again, the ability to set out outside of yourself and sort of command yourself to do something to go ahead, right?
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of those negative emotions that we're having, we just feel powerless and we feel guilt and we're just so focused on right here, right now, me.
Mm-hmm.
To get out of that. And I think, again, it's nice that they sort of go through and label what's happening physically inside. But that's just a small part of it, I would say, ultimately. Maybe not small, but a part of it.
You're saying to get up, get on, move on. Let's move forward.
What also is interesting here is, you know, they've taken this sort of very physicalist approach to these topics. Like, when you make a decision, this is what's happening in your brain. Implying, I think, that this is the reason that it's happening, and this is the reason to do it, so that you can have these chemical things happening in your brain. And I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much in it.
I guess I don't read it that way. I read it as your body's working the way it's supposed to work. And when we sit in negative feelings, when we have a lack of gratitude, when we're indecisive, the brain's actually struggling to try to move forward naturally, and we're stopping our human flourishment. And that's why. And so I see it like, versus, like you said, someone could say, oh, well, I just want the dopamine kick when I make good decisions because I set a goal and then I get some dopamine when I achieve it, which is great. But that's not the point. The point is that you're being decisive. You're making decisions. You're achieving good things, right?
Yeah, see, I think that's the correct way. I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Timory. I guess in my experience in talking with a lot of skeptics, they will look at neuroscience and say, well, look, we're just animals. We're just doing what our chemicals tell us to do. And when we do these things, it is either because of the chemicals or for the chemical rush that I'm going to get. And I would guard against that. That's all I'm saying. Guard against that reductionistic view. Indeed, the reductionistic view doesn't work because if it is true that we are just essentially animals or computers, we don't have free will, right? You are just...
That's the important thing. Yeah. We have intellect and free will, which the animal's just responding on an instinctual level. It begins to get hot, it sweats.
Right, or computers.
It gets to be hungry, it eats.
Computers especially, I think this is more the model these days, is that, well, we're just highly functioning computers and we're input-output machines. And when we get a positive response, that happens again, right? Mm-hmm. Well, no, that's not what we are, because if that was the case, you couldn't make those free choices. You couldn't step outside of yourself to examine your emotions. None of that would be possible. I just want to point that out for you atheists, and I know we have atheist listeners who think that, well, Don, this neuroscience is actually validating my atheistic worldview. No. Well, what we're saying is it actually doesn't. It validates a Christian worldview. It's actually saying things that Christians agree with.
Well, and that's where it's funny, again, entering into that level of modern spirituality, whatever that is to some people, where they don't have a faith, but they call themselves spiritual. A big part of that is being very goal-oriented and focusing on achieving. So this ties into this third element of neuroscience saying, hey, make decisions. Now, I disagreed with what they said, where they're like, well, just to make a decision, even if it's not the best one. I disagree with that. Because they actually said that in this article.
Right.
Just make a decision. You want to make good decisions. And that's fundamental to this. And that's where I think that they definitely go wrong, and where other neuroscientists, I know in their studies, would point out in here that good decisions make people happy.
Right. Well, again, and that's sort of what I've been saying throughout this article, is just be wary of the notion that neuroscience is the end all and be all.
Exactly.
And that we're just these machine type things, that just making the decision is the important thing. Well, no, it's not. But if we're going to make a proper decision, obviously we need a standard. Let's finish this up with the last one, which is interesting. Hugs, hugs, hugs is how they summarize it.
Sounds a little creepy.
It does. But they say touch other people. Be close enough that you can actually have physical contact, not in a creepy way, but have physical contact.
We're made for community, and simple things like a hand gesture. If you're facing something challenging and you're holding someone's hand, or they're touching you on their shoulder or something, you're able to endure better, especially when it's a loved one. Even things like math skills and team performance are better when there's some level of physical contact. Again, totally platonic and respectful, but it's just part of who we are. We're made to be in community.
Research shows, according to this article, getting 5 hugs a day for 4 weeks increases happiness big time. So 5 hugs a day. Not quick little hugs, apparently. No, you need long hugs. And again, this is...
I think that's creepy. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of long hugs. It's very rare.
Look at all the happiness that you're missing out on, Timmy.
But
if you have,
I think the better idea is that we're made to be around people, and this is, you know, Don. This is what it does get into, and that the article talks about, and we'll talk about this later. A lot of people are really lonely. They don't have any physical contact whatsoever, and that's why a lot of people are saying we need to be better about recognizing our need on a basic human level to be in community with people. A handshake. A squeezing of the hand, whatever it is, very simple. Let's not turn it into something that it's not, but recognize we need to be around people.
Yeah, we do have more articles on this. An excellent article from an only child who wishes she had some brothers and sisters. And apparently the biggest threat facing middle-aged men like myself is loneliness. So later on in the show. So again, just to summarize this before we take another break, God made us for love. The meaning of life is love. We are made to be dependent on Him and loving others. I mean, Jesus summed up the whole law, right? Love God and love others. Interesting that neuroscience has finally figured that all out.
Well, it's almost like neuroscience is the science of today, and which is great, especially as we're facing a lot of this gender ideology crisis. Neuroscientists are showing so many important elements that God created in the brain, showing the differences between men and women, the differences between happy and sad people, the differences between someone who's looking at porn and who's not looking at porn, and how it shrinks the frontal cortex of the brain. Like, very, very simple things that God created us in a clear way, and when we make stupid decisions, it impacts us.
Absolutely. You're listening to Trending with Dawn and Timmery. We'll be right back.
This is Trending with Dawn and Timmery on Immaculate Heart Radio. To learn more about Dawn Johnson or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit DawnJohnsonMinistries.org or Timmery.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.
So, Dawn, we had a request after our popular reading list that we recommended last week, some people said, hey, would you mind recommending some movies from the golden era of Hollywood? Which, by the way, I'm a huge fan of.
Oh.
I grew up in Lake Arrowhead.
Okay.
Known as the Playground of the Stars, where a bunch of the old Hollywood movie stars would come up and stay.
Really?
Still have homes. Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, the Beatles, all these different people had houses up there back
really?
In the heyday and still do.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. So, because when I think of the golden age of Hollywood, I, of course, think of classics like Top Gun, you know, those classic 80s.
You know, that definitely
that
wasn't on my
not,
list.
May not be the golden age that we were thinking about. That's cool. I love that. I, frankly, am not a connoisseur of golden age films.
Really?
I've seen a few, but yeah, I don't know.
So what's like an old movie that you can think of that you like or that you've seen?
Well, like I saw A Man for All Seasons not that long ago. So I mean, that's
but
sort of...
I don't think I've actually seen that.
Oh, which is great.
Who's in that one?
I should know that.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, it's okay. I'm really bad. I had to write it down ahead of time, truthfully. And I only really know old actors and actresses better. So, like, a couple, like, of my top recommendations, you know, you've got your Gene Kelly, who's an all-time favorite. Of course, you have, like, your classic Singing in the Rain, but my favorite Gene Kelly movies actually Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Oh, really?
Fantastic, fantastic movie. I'd strongly recommend it. It's a really good one. But he's got other good ones that used to be on Netflix, like Anchors Away and On the Town. A good horror movie. Again,
oh, really?
Old horror movie. And I'm not a fan of horror a lot of the time.
Either, no.
But this one's a good one because it doesn't have all of like the creepy evil elements to it. It's just good.
Yeah.
It would almost, I'd call it more suspense. And it's a movie called The Birds.
Oh, it's classic. Yeah.
Yeah. Classic The Birds. And then I last year fell in love with Cary Grant. I did not know that he was in that old movie, Arsenic and Old Lace. Have you ever seen it?
I have not seen
it. Okay, you've got to go and watch Arsenic and Old Lace. Watch it with your family because it'll be interesting to hear everyone's reactions. I think that they'll be shocked so many times they'll like it.
Well, trying to get my family, my kids especially, not my wife, she would love it, but my kids to watch the old films. Like, we homeschool, so sometimes you'll want to show little clips. And it's so unfortunate, I find, the expectations that my kids have for what should be on a screen if a screen is in front of them. Right? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, no, I don't want people really talking. Where's the chase? Where's the explosions? Where's the singing? Where's the something?
No, you
maybe
sound
the
like
old,
my mom.
Maybe the old musicals might be okay. Like Sound of Music, you know, I watched that a million times. I love
The
Sound of
Music.
Yeah,
it's a good movie.
Great
I didn't
movie.
Put that on there.
Is that considered golden age?
I think it is.
Latter golden
I think the
age.
End of
it's
it.
A great movie.
But Arsenic and Old Lace, I think it's just so shocking when I watched it. I had this attitude of, this is really weird, but it is, like, it has a lot of really interesting elements to it. And I don't want to tell you, like, it has a big moral aspect to it that you will laugh at because today it was so clear cut. But now it's so shocking. Like, even someone, I think, representing Margaret Sanger appears in it and has nothing to do with the main part of the story. But she, like, shows up knocking at the door as, like, a family planner. Like, here, let me help you plan your family.
Oh, wow.
But that's a really, really good one. Even if it's just you, the kids diss it, you got to see Arsenic and Old Lace.
All right.
And then To Catch a Thief with Cary Grant is a fantastic classic. And I'll throw out just a couple more. Doris Day. You've got to check out Do Not Disturb by Doris Day. I know a lot of grown men who love this movie. I think that's what's so charming about the old Hollywood films is that it's not one of those, hey, this is a chick flick. It's that you have strong male characters and strong female characters. And they're excellent. Same thing with Mother Dolores Hart is a nun, an older nun, formerly known as Dolores Hart, who was one of the main people who played alongside Elvis Presley. She has a book. She's a Catholic nun who left everything behind. But one of my favorite movies by her is Where the Boys Are. And it's a great spring break movie. That's what it is.
Huh.
You know, you face that challenges of sleeping around, going out of town, going on spring break. And it's totally relevant to today in so many ways.
Nice. All right. Well, it's not that I never watch old movies. I do like some of the old World War II movies, like Guns of Navarone, Great Escape, excellent movies, and the old Westerns. You know, I like the old John Wayne Westerns.
I never
They're always
really
good.
Watched any.
Oh, yeah.
What's your favorite John Wayne Western?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
There are a lot of good ones. There are a lot of them.
There's a lot of them.
So many. That's what's amazing. Some of these
I was going to say the one where he rides into town and saves the village from the evil.
They all blur together.
Maybe that's all of them. Yeah.
But that what that shows is this charmingness of these strong male characters. And I think a lot of boys actually are surprised by how much they like old movies because they're relevant to who they are today.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe even the old Clint Eastwood westerns, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Those are all good movies.
Mm-hmm.
So check those out. And if you have requests, feel free to send them to us. Find Timory at Twitter. You're much better at the Twitter thing than I am, frankly. And Instagram. You can find, I'm old, so I do Facebook.
I'll shoot it over to you. I do Facebook too, but...
It's sort of an older folks game these days, Facebook. Have you found that?
I like Facebook. A lot of the stuff, some of this came from Facebook, but yeah, a lot of the old people on there. I just don't like sharing my life on Facebook or anywhere for that matter. That's right. I feel like I made the mistake of doing that before.
Well, you're in the wrong business because you're in
Yeah, that's the other thing. Everyone wants to know too.
Oh yeah.
So I have a public Facebook page. I actually don't post on my private page anymore.
Because
if I'm going to post something, it's going to be something of like the work I'm doing or something I'm willing to share about my family or my friends. Otherwise, if I'm not going to post it there, why post it?
All right. One more quick movie reference before we switch topics. I think it was last week, Timory, you had brought up the notion that there is a trend in TV shows and movies for transhumanism, where you have the brain as the important thing, and they're taking the brain and hooking it up to computers and this sort of thing. Well, I just wanted to point this out. This trend is not slowing down anytime soon. This week, one of the hot new movies is called Ghost in the Shell. It's Scarlett Johansson, who apparently does these movies all the time. She's like the Hollywood poster girl for transhumanism. She's played a member. Here's the list. This comes from Stephen Gradanis, who you have heard on this network and a great writer for National Catholic Register. He's over at Decent Films. So Scarlett Johansson has played a member of the clone community, cultivated as organ donors. She has played, that was in The Island. She has played a seductive predator whose human appearance hides an alien body under the skin. She's played an artificial intelligence that evolves beyond humanity after a romantic fling. And a woman transformed by a super drug into a superhuman who transcends human limitations and ultimately existence herself. And now another one. So if you want the poster girl for transhumanism, it's Scarlett Johansson. Just that, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but just a quick shout out. Listen, here's another movie. It's coming out this week. The transhumanism thing, which essentially boils you down to your brain.
Yeah, your only brain, only your brain. Your brain can survive and you can live almost in this different world without your body being a part of your life. And you know what's funny about that, Don? Is that a while back, like earlier last year, we covered it in Hearts and Minds. There was a like robot made and it was of Scarlett Johansson. It looked just like her. And it was really creepy because it was almost like a you know what toy in a sense. And a lot of people were really weirded out. But now it makes sense why it was Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, apparently she's, and it's not even your brain. That's the thing. It's like the ideas, the memories are what is considered you. So a lot of times in these stories, the memories are downloaded off of the brain.
Exactly.
Right, into a computer.
Or all new memories, and that your brain can work through the puzzle. That's what, like, Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has been working through. You can put your body into this sleep, hook up the brain. It can combine both its current memories it has and then create a new world, and the brain has to work through this new world.
Yeah, and a lot of these stories are very, ultimately, anti-body and anti-human. I think that's why we need to keep just bringing this up.
Anti-body-soul connection.
Yeah, well, right. But if your body is just an appendage that is not necessary, that what are you going to do with it? How are you going to treat it? Well, as a toy, as an object to be decorated, but not you, right? And that's a huge problem. And then the question is, well, what is me? What am I as a human? It's really a question, ultimately, of what does it mean to be human? And again, Christianity, Catholicism especially, with our strong teaching on the unity of the body and soul.
We're not something different. And that's why we talk about neuroscience earlier in the show, is that we are a body and soul composite, and how God created the plants, the animals, the nature of the skies and the seas, and the human person is all part of our faith. You know, Catholics are, it refers to being universal, and it's true.
And this is one of the reasons, and we'll talk about this a little bit more when we come back from the break, but this is one of the reasons that study after study finds that pornography destroys human relationships and indeed the person itself. Because what is pornography at its base but the dehumanizing of another person.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You are just treating that person not as a person. In fact, you're not looking at them as a person at all when that image pops up on the screen. What are you looking at there? An image of someone's body.
We're connecting with images in technology and computer screens rather than another person.
Yeah. I think when you look at somebody on a screen, you're not thinking, well, there's someone's daughter. There's someone's girlfriend or boyfriend. Mm-hmm. Or you're not looking at the personhood of that. You're not looking at their memories, at their experiences. You're not looking at all that. Things that I think you are forced to interact with when you're actually in the presence of someone.
Yeah.
And that's what's so dangerous about our technological society now, and especially the prevalence of porn within that, is that we're dehumanizing everyone around us, and we end up not being able to have an actual relationship. That's the headline. We'll talk about it when we come back. You're listening to A Trending with Dawn and Timmery. Stick around.
Timmery and Dawn will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Dawn Johnson Media. Views expressed on Trending with Dawn and Timmery are for educational purposes only.
So, over the last week, the Kansas House has advanced a resolution condemning pornography, warning on a number of things that it treats, yes, women as objects. It lowers the desire to marry and can lead to erectile dysfunction, which, Dawn, I know a lot of people feel uncomfortable talking about it, but this is becoming a major issue among young men and even teenagers now.
Really?
Erectile
so young.
Dysfunction, because there's so many of them are looking at pornography, right? What happens is that it's leading to inadequate arousal, natural arousal that should take place. And you have young men picking up Viagra and different types of stimulants, essentially, right, that aren't doing the job. And it's becoming a real problem. And what people are just looking at this, they're saying, well, this is impacting relationships. That's why just another analysis of over 50 studies has recently come out, over 50,000 participants across 10 countries. And what we're seeing is that pornography is being looked at more and more in different areas, different countries, as a serious public health crisis. And it's leading men to both physical problems and how their bodies naturally function. It's leading to the shrinkage in the brain. You know, do you remember seeing images of alcoholics and drug addicts and how their brains would shrink?
Right.
We're seeing that happening even quicker with porn addicts. It's fascinating.
We need to do one of those, maybe you're too young to remember this, but the whole This Is Your Brain on Drugs, those ads that came out.
Yeah.
Where they'd I think it was fried eggs or something. Maybe we need to do a This Is Your Brain on porn.
Yeah. Well, that's why they're calling it the new drug. But what's interesting is that it's showing that it's leaving men more and more dissatisfied with real relationships. And we're talking about how it's leading to fewer people getting married. I think that so many men are struggling in their relationships because they have these expectations or this physical stimulus that's taking place on a neurological level that's impacting the natural flow of how the brain works on a basic relational level.
Well, right. To have a relationship, you have to be able to, at some level, give of yourself to another person.
Yeah.
That's what love is, right?
Yes.
So if you're going to have a relationship, I don't know if you've ever had one of those relationships where the other person simply will not give to you, will not open up.
They just have this expectation for you to do one thing after another.
Or they're just a closed book. Like, I'm trying to get to know that person,
yes,
but they just won't. Well, that's because in order to know them, they have to allow themselves to be known. And that involves giving themselves a little bit to you, trusting.
Being vulnerable. And I know men, we don't like that imagery, the idea of vulnerability. You don't even have to call it that. But it's the fact that you're sharing a part of who you are, whether what you're talking about, your life experiences. You don't even have to share your struggles right away. just who you are.
Right. Well, and that's just basic, like, relationship. Like, you and I are sitting across the table here, Timmery. I have to be able to give of myself to you a little bit, and you have to be able to give of yourself, or we're not going to have any sort of relationship. But here's what happens, I think, with all of these men, especially, now even though more women are now getting involved in porn, there is none of that. There is no giving of yourself. It's a strictly using thing. Mm-hmm. That other, it's not even a person anymore, just an object. Well, when that is transferred into a real life situation, where you're sitting across from someone, a real life woman, but the last 20 hours you've spent on the computer only looking at women as objects, and now suddenly here's this woman in front of you, your natural inclination is, I'm going to objectify that woman.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? That doesn't work. There's no relationship possible if I'm only seeing you as an object. And so I think there's a, you know, that's why there's such a direct correlation. Essentially, we're killing love.
Mm-hmm.
Porn kills love. And when you kill love, you don't have relationships with anyone. That's how it
because
works.
Because it kills our ability to love rightly, which then makes it challenging to give and interact.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. You can't, unless you give, there's no love like that. Loving is giving.
It's a willing the good of the other, having an attitude
right.
of I want what is best for you. And that doesn't mean me being in isolation. That doesn't mean just having what I want. That means there's a reciprocity. There's a complementarity between the two people in any relationship, friendship, whatever it is.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's what porn thwarts that. And if it's thwarting it on a relational level between male and female and dating, I guarantee you it's impacting every single one of our friendships and familial friendships.
Absolutely. It's impacting the culture as a whole. And maybe that's why you see this article at the Boston Globe. The biggest threat facing middle-aged men isn't smoking or obesity, says the headline. It's loneliness. Middle-aged men simply don't have many friends.
Mm-hmm.
And the author was sent out, Billy Baker was sent out on a quest, and he realized not only is this true, his editor assigned him this
and
this
he
story.
Felt kind of singled out, like, why are you
like,
giving
this
to me?
I've got friends. And he started to think about it. No, he didn't. But not only did he not have any, really, that many his age did not.
And we're not even just talking about a single middle-aged man. This is a man in what sounds like a great marriage with children and who is a great father. But he recognized there was something missing, and that was other friendships.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't have to tie that directly to porn. I think porn is a symptom of a very self-centered society.
Yes.
And we certainly have been creating a self-centered society now for many, many decades. Mm-hmm. I mean, my era in the 80s was called the me decade, not mm-hmm. for no reason, right? I mean, we were told
sexual revolution, kids.
Yeah, you focus on yourself, you get what's best for yourself. And so we have a whole couple of generations now that have been focusing on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that that actually doesn't work out very well.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting here, it's mentioned in the article that it's now okay and normal and good to say if you're depressed because all our awareness of mental health issues. It's totally fine for you to share with me that you're depressed. There's no stigma to it. But there is a stigma still right now to share if you're lonely.
Hmm.
And I think that across the board, not even just with middle-aged men, this is something that a lot of people are struggling with. We're living longer, single, young adult lives. We're going further into education that usually requires that you have no children, no spouse whatsoever a lot of the time. A lot of people are struggling, and you add the increase of divorce and all the marital challenges on top of that. A lot of people are struggling here.
Here's an interesting headline from Claire Hanscom touching on something that I'm sure a lot of people have thought but maybe been unwilling to say. The headline is, I'm an only child. I'll always wish I wasn't. And here she's talking about being raised by herself. She says, don't get me wrong. It wasn't all bad. You know, my books were never torn by sticky finger toddlers. When my father passed away recently, I inherited a significant sum that I didn't have to share with anybody. She says, but I'd give all that up. I'd give all that up just to have grown up with a sibling or two, to have someone to roam on the beach with, to play Monopoly with, to do all the things. And I, again, this gets to the heart of a very real issue that we don't address strongly enough in the culture, even as Catholics, maybe like, mm-hmm. hey, we were made for each other. We were made to love.
Well, and it gets the fact that men need male friendship for accountability, for self-giving, for getting to know themselves better. And it's important to make a priority for that. But even young people, especially if you're an only child or if you have an only child, your kids need friends around, whether it's cousins or whatever it is. I grew up not only with three siblings, but with a bunch of cousins around. And there was an intentional attempt to make that happen.
I saw an interesting article just this morning, Timory, about millennial men and their surprising, according to the pollsters, their surprising desire to have a wife who stayed home and raised a family. This was interesting. I mean, I think it ties in a little bit here that there has been a reaction now to some of the sexual revolution stuff. Mm-hmm. To want to have a bunch of kids to run around with and to have a family that's nuclear and we're not just, mm-hmm. you know, that we're not just all out for ourselves.
To have a home.
To have a home.
And that friendship of a spouse. Yeah. I think that's also part of the struggle with this male friendship, as well as there's a lack of understanding beforehand your relationship's based on a friendship.
Yeah.
And that's what comes first. And I think that I'm seeing a lot of people, especially in their young adult years, appreciating this more, that they're not just necessarily jumping into relationships, but through some of like the tough circumstances they're experiencing, they're really being called to develop friendships.
Yeah.
And that's why we're seeing, I think, a surge in really strong marriages right now, too.
It's interesting, isn't it? The millennial generation actually may bring things back from the brink. I mean, we've been to the sexual revolution. We've started to see the results. We have a whole list of articles that we've covered these two shows this week on trending, Timory. And to one degree or another, many people are reacting against the sexual revolution and what it has done to their families. And so we see this surge in, it's a pro-life generation. It's a pro-marriage generation. Mm-hmm. It's a pro-love generation, you know, pro-friendship. Like, please, let's have families. Let's settle down. Let's love each other.
Be peace, but let's actually have authenticity.
Yeah.
And because they're searching for authenticity.
Yeah. Quick plug here before we end the show on a related subject. I'm actually making a documentary about the sexual revolution and its serious consequences in our culture.
So needed.
Yeah, it's called Unprotected. You can find out more about that at reversetherevolution.com. For those of you that have subscribed to the Hearts and Minds podcast in the past or the Don Johnson Radio Show podcast in the past, don't forget to migrate over and subscribe to our new podcast, Trending with Don and Timory. And please leave a review.
And I'm just going to emphasize there, it's so important, not just because I want to hear, oh, how great the hosts are. Please, it's not the reason why. Because when you leave reviews, when people search for Catholic podcasts and so forth on their phone, on iTunes, we actually begin to come up. And I have to tell you, I've met some really neat people who are struggling through things with what the church is teaching on contraception is, or the radical gender ideology they're experiencing. And they said, you helped me to kind of begin to wade the waters of understanding this topic. And it was just by a simple search. So if you don't rate and review, we don't pull up as high. So please share this podcast with others, not only by sharing it on social media, but by giving a review.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next week.
This has been Trending with Don and Timory on Immaculate Heart Radio.
Trending.
To learn more about Don Johnson or Timory Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit donjohnsonministries.org or timory.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.